This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hello and welcome to the third and final edition of a series of special short episodes of the Known and Ever podcast, part of the Talk Sport Fan Network. This week, as Christmas approaches and more importantly, the return of club football, we are featuring three Burnley Football Club related books that would make great gifts for the Clarets in your life. In our first episode, we heard from Michael Hodkinson, author of the brilliantly titled Known and Ever book on the East Lancs derby. And in our second episode, we heard from club legend Barry Kilbey, who has published his memoirs, Starting From Scratch. In this episode, we're hearing from sports author and Clarets fan Tim Quelch, whose new book, Northern Exposure, is a 50-year-old diary of watching Burnley FC rise, fall and rise again. We have a copy of Northern Exposure to give away, so do stay tuned to our social channels for your chance to win. Producer Matt sat down with Tim this week and asked him about his latest book and how it all came about.
So we are delighted to welcome to the No Name Ever podcast author Tim Quelch. Tim, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thank you, man. Fine, thank you.
Very good. Now, Tim is an established author. You've written books about different sports. You've written books about Burnley before this, and those previous Burnley books have focused on maybe a specific season or a specific period. What prompted you to take a wider look at Burnley's history, and in particular this 50-year period that the book covers?
Well, part of it was to do with the fact that I spent 50 years of my life supporting Burnley in some way. There have been times where it's been fairly dormant because I've lived so far away. But I wanted to leave my wife and daughter with something of the experience that they had, going to football together over this 50-year period. I also wanted to bring the start of that process, where I started watching them in March 1970. And what I wanted to do in this was to draw some parallels with the two main actors at the start of my football watching with Burnley, with it at its end under Sean Dyche. So I did look at some sort of comparisons between Jimmy Adamson, who was the manager when I first watched them, with the manager right at the close of the 50-year period, which Sean Dyche. Both were highly respected as tacticians, and both suffered from early flak from their fans. There was a chance for Adamson to be sacked in his second year, and Dyche went through a pretty rough spell too. In his first season, they hit a very barren And there were a lot of calls for his head, to remember, during that period. But both of them led their sides back to the top flight. Jimmy Addison fell out of the team, fell out of the first division in 1971. And he led them back there in 1973, whereas Dyche took Burnley back to the first division within 2 years. But there were some differences too that I thought I should clarify. Dyche's period in charge was over twice the length that Adamson was manager. And when Dyche took Burnley back to the Premier League in his second promotion, he managed to keep them there for six seasons. Whereas with Adamson, he only kept them there for under three years. The other striking difference was that Adamson believed in youth. He thought that he could run a successful side with young men that were, many of whom were under 20. Whereas Dyche favoured experienced players. Dwight McNeil was probably one of his few attempts to sort of experiment with younger players. But both of them had to fight above their weight in order to stay in the top flight. And what was being very clear during this period, this 50-year period, it's been harder and harder to retain a position of the top of English football. Both managers struggled with a lack of resources. When I started watching Burnley, I was then with my girlfriend, latterly became a wife, and we were fanatical once we'd got through our training, because we both were training in different places. There was very little money. It was very difficult to get to any games because the money was so tight. But after we've completed our respective trainings, me as a social worker and her as a teacher at that time, we went to just about every game for three years. There's 3 years spent in the first division. We did see them occasionally outside that period, but that was a period where this bug really gripped. And the daughter came to football at a time of a family tragedy. The close relative was dying of cancer. And she found it very distressing and asked me to take her to a football match, having shown no interest whatsoever beforehand. And that started off another sort of 10-year period where we went to the football together, going all over the country, until she got old enough that boys and other activities took sort of first place. So I wanted to have something to leave them, that my health isn't great, and I wanted to have, that's why I wanted to do this last book, so that there was something left for them about the days that we shared together.
The book does contain lots of details about the matches that you attended back in the 1970s and the 1980s. Did you keep detailed records of these travels and the moments that you're able to then call on when writing this book and add so much detail to it?
Yeah, I mean, I did keep sort of copious records. And I used to write to people a lot in those days when, you know, sending letters to one another was, you know, so much more the thing to do. And you know, used to send you know, sort of summaries of the games that I watched and so on. So there's some of that, but it's also been buttressed by the fact that so many other people have put stuff to writing. You know, in the London Clarets, there's any number of people that write copiously about the team, you know, and in various games and so on. So it's been very useful to be able to conflate some of that, especially now that my memory isn't as sharp as it used to be. Up until about 15 years ago, I could remember every game I saw, and I could remember just about every goal scorer. But I also got a lot of information from the local papers. The local papers were very good. I used to go into Burnley Library when I was doing the Never Had It So Good book, and spent ages in there with the microfiche, you know, going through. And as Tony Scholes has said, that it's the trouble is that it's so easy to get to distracted because there's so many sort of bizarre stories in there that you know, that grab your attention. I'd also I picked up a lot of information from YouTube and ITV Hub, who's done a whole rerun of the big match from the 70s. But on YouTube, you can go back to see games in the early days of Match of the Day, which then there was only one game shown. So you get 50 minutes of the action, you know, which gives you a much better feel of what the game was about. You know, I find the Match of the Day now sort of a bit, I mean, I will watch it from time to time, but it's too short, you know. It's just, you don't get a sense of how the game's panned out. Just see a few goals and near misses. I've also got a good friend who has been collecting odd bits of newsreel for years, and he's kindly sort of lent these to me, and I've made good use of that. So it's been a lot easier to get a sense of not only just how the game was played, but also the occasion, about the sort of the involvement of the crowd, the weather. I mean, some of the pitches back in the 60s and the 70s were absolute disgrace. You know, that there was the mud literally came up to the sort of the you know, to come over their boots. You know, it was it's amazing that they could produce such good football in such awful conditions. But I love all that because it's so atmospheric, and hearing the, you know, the music too that was playing at the time, you know, the ground before the game started and so on.
That's great. Yeah, I know part of our team, Dave Roberts, a statistician, Burnley statistician, he's currently spending a lot of time in the libraries, kind of documenting all the kind of the newspaper footage to add to his database as well. And, you know, he's working his way slowly backwards through the years. So I think he's finding that quite interesting, you know, compiling those reports to add to the numbers that he has as well.
It's a real labour of love.
Mm, it is. So for this book, you spoke to some players and staff, both past and present. Which of those were you able to talk to when compiling this this record, and how did their memories of their time at the club compare?
There were some differences, as you might expect. I mean, for instance, on the I met with both Barry Kilby and Clive Holt on separate occasions, and Clive was adamant that Burnley would have survived in 1987 had they failed to beat Orion. Barry Kilby was very sceptical about that. Clive was felt that he would be able to sort of surmount the sufficient financial resources to keep the club going. But I think there's a lot of doubt about that, because it was a time, wasn't it, when coal and dynamos were flourishing, and people were being drawn there rather than to Turf Moor. I mean, some of the gates were in that 86-87 season were pitiful, weren't they? About 1,500, like that. And I mean, in such a big stadium, it must have been absolutely awful. When I was talking with Barry Kilby about it, he was as doubtful as I was about the fact that how the club could cope in the conference, as it, I think it was called then, given the fact that all the overheads that were required, the heating, the lighting, hot water and all the rest of it, with probably a dwindling of even further the number of fans dwindling even more. He didn't feel that it was viable to keep Turf Moor as Burnley's ground, well, whatever, if they did manage to survive, because of all those add-ons, alongside the debts that they're already carrying. So I suppose that's one example of where there've been differences. When I was talking with Martin Dobson and Jeff Nolte, I spoke with Jeff Nolte over the phone, but I saw Martin Dobson face to face. Well, both of them were very reverential towards Jimmy Adamson, and could see he thought that he was all good for the club, you know, that he introduced a standard of play that they hadn't attained previously, even though that they'd had success in the 59-60 season. And but talking to Steve Kindon, he was equally adamant that Adamson had no man management skills. And he cited an example where he was told that by Adamson to buy a house that summer, when Kindon asked him whether he should buy or rent, he said he'd definitely buy. And within a few days, he was shifted off to Wolves. And he's never forgotten that. He, you know, every time Adamson's name is mentioned, he vilifies him. So he felt that he was badly let down by him. But it wasn't just that. He found him arrogant, and he was very moody, apparently. And he compares him very unfavourably with Harry Potts, who he had a lot of time for. He recognised that he wasn't the best tactician in the world, but he cared for his players. And there was one instance where Kindon was thrown out by his landlady, and Harry Potts come and picked him up, took him home, kicked the kids out of their beds and let him sleep there tonight till something else could be settled. And just as that bad experience of Adamson stays the course, it's the same with Harry Potts, who I understand was very supportive to Ralph Coates when he was going through a period of bereavement. So when Kindon came back to Burnley, Harry Potts was the manager there. And for a couple of seasons, it was like a golden period for him, and for ourselves, I think, too.
Hi.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Out of the 50 years, are there any particular seasons that that stand out in your mind? That what some of your favourite periods of watching Burnley?
The first season that I really enjoyed was the 73-74 season. It was the first season up. They'd won the Charity Shield in pre-season. And they were up against Leeds, who were, it was the championship winning season. And they, but as much as Leeds set a hot pace, Burnley kept up with them until roughly about Christmas time, and after that it fell away somewhat. But what I remember most about that season, which makes it a special one for me, was the 5-1 trouncing of Leeds at Elland Road. And it was just so unexpected, really, because they hadn't been beaten at home in the league. They'd been beaten at home by Bristol City, I think it was, in the cup, but it was a fortress there, and to smash them so, you know, completely was just incredible to watch. It might have been different because Leeds did have a prolonged period in the first half when they were well on top, but as soon as they equalised, then Fletcher scored that brilliant bicycle kick goal. And it was nice to see too that the guy that that Leeds players had identified as a bottler, Dougie Collins, had such a fantastic game. I mean, he scored one goal and he created two others, and he put as much as anybody contributed to that performance. The sad thing about it, of course, was that Casper suffered that awful injury from the tackle, thigh-high tackle from Norman Hunter. And his career was finished, though he came back and played odd games. Within a year or so, he had to give it up. And he was such an important player for the club. It was a big miss. And of course, the following week they lost a semi-final against Newcastle. So it had its ups and downs, but it was a terrific season. And the win over Liverpool at Christmas was a remarkable game too. It was played in awful conditions, torrential rain, mud oozing everywhere, but it was a great game. So that game particularly sticks in them, or that season sticks in the mind. The season that followed, well, we started with quite a sort of a bit of despondency, really, because Martin Dobson was sold to Everton. It thought it was going to be a really hard season, but for most of it, they sailed along until they met Wimbledon, of course, in the FA Cup, which was a huge embarrassment. I mean, a number of were only place there, and they wouldn't go out after that game because they felt so shamed. But there are several others too that stick in the mind. The recovery from when they went down, in 1977, they were rock bottom, well adrift of the next club, and Steve Kindin came back, and he almost single-handedly turned things around. He had so much power. I mean, he was he scored a brilliant goal on the first game that I saw at Turf Moor. And the speed and power, and he was strong too. He had huge upper body strength. The players tended to bounce off him, you know, because once he was in his stride, he was very, very difficult to stop. And that was a cracking season because they from being relegation certainties, as it seemed, to being almost within striking distance of the playoff positions. If it was playoffs, then I should not remember. But they were pretty near the top by the end of the season. And then there was, after the depression of the fall into the third division, that's a new low for the club. I went to see a game. It was one of the very few games that I saw at Bristol. We lived there for 5 years. We didn't have very much money. We had to stay in lodges and so on to sort of keep our heads above water. And there was this game against between Burnley and Bristol City. I mean, Bristol City were in an awful situation. They were hugely in debt. But Burnley had recovered some momentum. But going into this game, Bristol City got in front in the early part of the second half. But then this lad who I can't remember how old he was then, Trevor Stephen, he was 17, 18, something like that. And he just run this game. He was phenomenal. I thought, just on that first sight, I thought, this lad's going to play for England. And it was no surprise to me when, I mean, it happened while he was at Everton. But, I mean, nothing troubled him. He played with his socks around his ankles. But he played with, on this mire, another rat pitch. He played as if he was on a bowling green. And it was absolutely funny. He tore them apart. He was constantly looking for the killer pass and more often than not made it. And Burnley came back from a 2-1 down to win 3-2. They should have won it by a lot more, actually, because it was like shooting fish in a barrel at the end. They were just all over them. So that stays very fondly in my mind.
In your book, you reference social events that were happening alongside each period of Burnley's history. How much do you think these wider events affected the game of football and Burnley in particular?
I think that it has impinged upon football considerably. What's been happening outside, whether you're talking about the Falklands War or the three-day week and the floodlight ban, now about Ukraine. It's not possible to separate sport from all this stuff that's going around. And just as music has a hold on me, I associate it with a particular game or occasion. So it is with these important events. I mean, I felt like in the Falklands War, I mean, it was treated by some as if a bit like a World Cup qualifier. You know, there was the here we go, pub jingoists, who, you know, sort of chanting, well, and it was all stoked up by the tabloids, the Sun in particular. You know, stick it up your junta and one or two other ones I won't mention. I think it's a mistake to see sport in some way separated from life. And life embraces, it includes politics and what have you. So that's why I put it in, because, well, for me anyway, it's maybe not everybody's reaction, but it's mine. And that's why I put it in.
It certainly, as I was reading through a lot of the book, it certainly added a kind of a flavour and a context, and it just helped you to conjure up a wider picture of the period that you were, you know, reading about as you work your way through the book. Under Daesh, Burnley were regularly labelled overachievers. Is this a label you would apply to other parts of their history?
I think ever since the glory days, they've been overachievers. There have been times where, honestly, they haven't been so good. But I mean, generally speaking, that, in my opinion, applies. I may not go along with Alan Pace about his idea that he wants Burnley to be everybody's favourite underdog. But the fact is that they've had to fight for their right to sort of stay in the Football League, let alone the higher echelons. So that's why I think that it's not an insult in my book. I mean, I think it's a compliment, quite frankly, because they have had to fight their way to get back into top tier football with limited resources. I mean, there've been times when there's been a bit more money going around, but generally speaking, it's been short. And the fact that they've managed to achieve what they've done is absolutely phenomenal. That's why I always regard Sean Dyche as their best, in my lifetime, their best Burnley manager. How he managed to do that. I know it wasn't good at the end, but...
That's certainly some plaudit for him to have, given the number of managers that you'll have witnessed over the 50 years. This summer saw massive change to the first team set up at the club and follows on just 18 months after the ALK takeover, which has seen much change away from the pitch. What have you made of all this change, and what are your hopes of Burnley's future under this leadership, both at boardroom and pitch level?
I think, like a number of other supporters, I think they're a bit anxious about whether this is going to work. I mean, it does seem to be counterintuitive to be doing a leveraged takeover in Burnley. You know, it's something that sits a bit more easily, well, at least in my limited view, with, you know, the sort of big clubs like Manchester United and so on. But I suppose that, you know, and even though there's been things going on recently, hasn't there, which has sort of caused some anxiety about Companies House and what have you. From what I've seen this season, I mean, I'm going to curse them now, but I didn't expect to see such wonderful football being played, and now successfully wonderful football. And I think, well, all these players have been brought in. I mean, I know several of them are loans, but they've been brought in for probably less than it costs to buy Maxwell Cornet. And I'm thinking, well, because I remember something that Alan Pace said way back, that their aim was to find talented players, bring them on, and sell them for a profit, which was basically what we did in the 60s and early 70s, the sort of the sell to survive policy. And I think, well, perhaps there is something in this, you know, that if, I mean, a lot depends on having the right manager. And I think, like a lot of people that, I'm a little bit concerned about this talk about whether he would leave the club for Belgium. I think he's done a phenomenal job in picking up these players that were clearly under the radar. Because, I mean, although a number of them were the clubs allegedly had some interest in, it wasn't one that they pursued with any vigour. And yet they're playing for us, you know, and playing brilliantly. And so I'd like to feel more optimistic about it now, you know, but I'm still worried about the debt that exists, because after all, we were a club in profit before they took over.
So Tim's book, Northern Exposure, is now available. It's been published by Pitch Publishing and is widely available wherever you find your books. And I would urge you all to go out and get a copy of it. And depending on your vintage or how long you've been watching the Clarets, certain parts of it, if not all of it, will take you on a good trip down memory lane. Tim, thank you for talking to us on the podcast this week.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'll keep in everything crossed that the season continues as successfully as the first half has taken us.
Thank you very much, Matt.
The Known and Ever podcast is brought to you in association with the TalkSport Fan Network. Natalie Bromley is the host and editor, and the show is produced by Matt Moss. Our resident statistician is Dave Roberts, and our FPL expert is Adam Dennett. The analysis show team is collectively Tom Whittaker, Richard Steele, George Poole, Charlotte Rigby, Adam Dennett and Robbie Kopak. Our music is provided by George Gaskill, and our newsletter team is headed up by Jamie Smith. If you don't already, you can subscribe to our newsletter by visiting nonadnever.substack.com. Our thanks as ever go to our partners TalkSport. We are, as ever, proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.